Hello, friends, and welcome to Conversations with Consequences. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association, where we aim to change the culture one conversation at a time. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern, or catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on Sirius XM channel 130. Of course, our radio show is also a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org or directly to wherever you listen to your podcast. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your host today, Ashley McGuire, and we're so fortunate to have back with us our friend, Ryan Anderson. Ryan is a prolific writer. He's written many books and many more articles. And he's also the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a very consequential think tank in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Hey, and before we launch into talking about your very interesting article in First Things, I understand that congratulations are in order and that you are expecting another baby.
Well, I was gonna mildly correctly to say my wife is expecting the baby.
Yes.
Only because my transgender ideology side of
Yes, that's true. Yes. We've both written books about sex differences, so we should. Yes. I should be more clear on that.
No, well, it's fine.
Congratulations to you and to your wife. So
thank you. And I don't know when this will air, but as we're recording, it was yesterday morning that we discovered our cow gave birth. So I thought
wow.
we were going to say congratulations on the baby cow, but
the baby
is even better.
Congratulations on both babies. Well, speaking of babies, we wanted to talk with you today about your article in First Things entitled The Way Forward After Dobbs. And I have it all marked up because it's a really important read and a very clear-eyed analysis of where we are after this consequential overturning of Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court. And you make it clear that, yes, we won the big legal battle that we've been fighting for 50 years, but in the meantime, we've essentially lost the culture. How so?
Yeah, so, and I may not say it that strongly that we lost the culture, but we've lost ground in the culture. I think I would phrase it that way only because I think how to enter into the essay. Because, the essay is like 4,000 or 5,000 words long. So it makes a lot of points along the way. But one of the points that I make is that a lot of the best parts of the pro-life movement, the most consequential, especially like in D.C., were the legal parts of it. It was, the parts of the pro-life movement that were focused on overturning Roe, because the pro-life movement knew that so long as Roe v. Wade was the precedent of the land, it would prevent legal protection for unborn babies. And you look at something like the Federalist Society, you look at something like Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF, massive law firm that, helped shepherd the Supreme Court case that overturned Roe. FedSoc, the group that's responsible for all of the justices that voted to overturn Roe. Those groups are very sophisticated. They're very strategic. They're very well funded. But we don't have anything like that on the cultural side. Many of the single issue pro-life groups, Susan B. Anthony List, AUL, they've been doing great work. SBA List, getting pro-life members of Congress and the Senate elected so they could then vote to confirm those justices, right? AUL doing a lot of the state legal work. But we don't have anything trying to reform culture. We don't have anything with the same sophistication geared towards the churches. And then the second thought I would add is that it's also the case that it's, to my mind, not primarily about the sanctity of life as such, but it's about the sacrifices people are willing to make to recognize and respect the sanctity of life. And all of those sacrifices intersect with the sexual revolution. So at some point in the essay, I make the point that there are a lot of people who, I quote Bill Maher, and Bill Maher says, look, the pro-life activists say that abortion is murder, and they're kind of right. I just don't care, right? Or I'm just in essence, not willing to make sacrifices on my sex life because sex makes babies, and then a certain number of those babies people are not going to be willing to sacrifice to care for, or people aren't going to be willing to refrain from sex outside of marriage. And there's nothing like a pro-chastity movement in the United States. Go ahead.
That was really kind of one of my key takeaways. And you do such a good job of citing the statistics of how even among people who go to church and go to church regularly, we're in the single digits for people who are, you know, chaste on their wedding night. And even, you know, when it comes to abortion, I think you had a statistic in there, something like 30% of women who had abortions go to church like once a month or something.
Yep.
And so it really shed a light on the fact that, and I think you make this point in the article, that, you know, maybe where we need to start is with people who go to church. And I love the idea of a kind of a revamped chastity movement. What would that look like to you? Is this something, I mean, because, you know, we grew up around the same time, and this was when, you know, talking about chastity was considered almost moronic. Like you were mocked, even though it still remains the, you know, the single best way to not have an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy. But how do we make chastity cool again?
Right. I mean, I think at one point in the essay, I say something like, you know, no one wants to be a professional prude.
Right.
And there's some truth to that, because, right, it's not going to be cool. And it's going to, you know, it's hard to raise money for this. Like, you know, which donors want to be saying, I'm donating to the chastity cause? Like, what foundation or institution wants to be a single issue chastity organization, et cetera, et cetera. And at one other point in the essay, I say something like, before we try convincing the secular world to live by a Christian sexual ethic, we might try convincing Christians to live by a Christian sexual ethic. And so I think, I mean, the church is the place to start. J.P. DeGantz, I imagine he's a friend of yours, a friend of mine. He has really done just great work with his organization called Communio, which is meant to come alongside parishes, local churches, and help them with their marriage ministries. I mean, what he's discovered is that something like 80% of parishes don't have a marriage ministry. And of those that do have a marriage ministry, they have nothing after like pre-Cana. And so his perspective is, you know, if we can get more people married, and if we can then help people stay married, you know, this is going to be good for the church, good for evangelization. Part of his argument, he has all sorts of data that shows, had Americans simply kept getting married at the same rates, we wouldn't have seen any decline in church membership or church attendance. That, you know, the causal link here, and Mary Eberstadt had made this point in her book about secularization, is that, you know, the mutually reinforcing, either for good or ill, is as families fail to form, as families break down, so too does religious adherence. And then as religious adherence starts to wane, so too does marriage and family formation, right? And so they're mutually supportive for good or ill. Two other statistics to share. I wanted to look up what are the stats about who gets aborted and who has abortions. And so the two statistics that I share is, it's 4% of babies conceived inside of marriage that will be aborted, contrasted to 40% of babies who are conceived outside of marriage, right? So almost half of babies conceived outside of marriage will be aborted. So that's the one, you know, who will be aborted stat. The other stat is who has an abortion. Of all of the abortions that take place in the United States, 13% of them were performed on married women. 87% of them were performed on unmarried women. And so that just leads me to the conclusion that marriage is the greatest protector of unborn babies, because marriage attaches, you know, the man and the woman to each other as husband and wife, to then be father and mother to any kids that their sexual relationship produces. And, you know, even as I say that, I'm like, that was like the talking point that we used over a decade ago in the same-sex marriage debate, right? These truths haven't changed. Human nature being what it is, our embodiment as male and female, the sex drive being what it is. The sex drive hasn't changed, but if marriage rates keep declining, and if the age of first marriage keeps getting delayed, there's going to be more and more non-marital sex. The non-marital sex is going to create non-marital pregnancies. And then a certain percentage of parents will say, I'm not prepared to be a parent, and they will choose to abort their child. And I think that's going to need to be a new area of focus for the pro-life movement. And we're going to have to get there. We're not yet there, but people are thinking about this. And, I think in particular, the church can be a starting point for this. And I think some of the work that JP has been doing with Communio is a good model of where to start.
Yeah. And it just makes sense. I mean, I was so struck when I saw that since the advent of the hormonal birth control pill, the percentage of pregnancies that are quote unquote unplanned in this country went up. And the only thing that's changed is that the percentage of couples that have made a lifelong commitment to each other and to whatever comes down the road, including those pregnancies you weren't expecting or planning on, has plummeted. And so, of course, we're going to just see rampant abortion rates. Another point that you made in the beginning of your essay is about the law as a teacher and the fact that we've had 50 years of what you call the darkening of our national conscience. So 50 years of the law telling us from the absolute highest level that abortion is okay, and not just okay, but is an inherent right that's intrinsically tied to the flourishing of women. And I was thinking about the fact that, we had the same thing with the Supreme Court with slavery and then segregation. And it took decades to untangle that socially and to teach people that racism is inherently wrong and is a sin. And I mean, how, many people have said that the election of President Trump sort of buys us some time to stop some of the bleeding at the state level with these abortion ballot initiatives, and to try and sow new seeds culturally. But is it enough time? I mean, how much time do we need to teach people basically to start over with people and to try and teach people who, as you point out, will look at an ultrasound and know that that's a baby, it has a beating heart, but that ending its life is intrinsically evil.
Yeah, there's so much there. Let me try to answer in kind of like three thoughts. One is that I think that the pedagogical, the teaching impact of Roe v. Wade wasn't just like the head knowledge that abortion is a right and therefore the unborn have no rights, but it also was like a habituation into the lifestyle of the sexual revolution, the lifestyle of the hookup culture, the lifestyle of the normalization of non-marital sex. Because to a certain extent, it's both contraception, as you had mentioned earlier, so the Griswold decision, and then Roe v. Wade, that are like the technologies of contraception and abortion, and then the bad, unconstitutional Supreme Court rulings, activism from the court, that fueled, that allowed the sexual revolution to take place, right? And people have always wanted to have sex outside of marriage, right? Human nature hasn't changed. It's always been a temptation. It's always been something people desired, but it was much more limited prior to these technological innovations. There's a paper by Janet Yellen and her husband, George Akerlof, where they point out that, look, the reason that you saw this statistic you mentioned, that after the advent of the contraceptive pill and after people were taking it on a regular basis, you actually saw abortion rates go up and marriage rates go down, is that it was now, well, it's your body, your choice, right? And so there was no kind of expectation of the shotgun wedding, which used to be a cultural norm, that premarital sex was truly premarital. It wasn't non-marital. The idea being that, if you slept with someone and you were pregnant, it would then lead to doing the right thing, marrying the person, taking responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. So one thought is just that Roe v. Wade not only taught us that abortion is right, the unborn have no rights, but it has habituated us. It's allowed for two generations of misguided sexual behavior. Second is that you see the big change in public opinion. And I cite a bunch of Gallup polls right around 2016. And I think what that shows, public opinion had largely been stable for decades. And I think with Scalia dying and then Senate Majority McConnell leaving the seat open so that the people could decide during the election, you know, who they wanted to nominate Scalia's successor, and then Trump winning that election, I think a lot of people started saying, oh, wait, like there's a real possibility that Roe could be overturned. And that means I could have skin in the game in the sense of it could be my abortion or my girlfriend's abortion or my daughter's abortion that would now be prohibited. And so you see just, you know, really significant change of general public opinion. And then I break it down, young women or young people in general, women in particular, and then Democrats in particular, just huge divergence. And really bad in terms of like next generation. It's something like 80-some% of 20 and 30 year olds right now favor first trimester abortion. And then women, it's been like a 10-point change. And then Democrats, it's more or less abortion on demand. So, you know, Kamala Harris was not out of step with the base of her party. And I think what that symbolizes is just that, you know, some of it might have been a backlash to Trump, who knows, but I think it was more what he symbolized and then what he and his justices accomplished, which was the overturning of Roe. I've used the line that, you know, historically people have said I'm in favor of three exceptions, rape, incest, life of the mother. What we're discovering in these ballot initiatives is that voters want a fourth exception, which is my case, or again, my daughter, my wife, whoever. So that's the second thought. Last thought is, there has been a huge unanswered lies that the media and activists have told about these state pro-life laws. So much of, I think, the reason why, you know, you take those first two changes and then you add in the third explains why we've been losing at the state ballot initiatives is that there are genuinely people who think miscarriage will now be illegal. Ectopic pregnancy, you will not be able to get treatment for it. You know, mothers will be dying because of these pro-life laws, despite the fact that every state that has a pro-life law on the books has explicit provisions in those very pro-life laws that, you know, no one will be denied life-saving medical care. No one will be denied treatment for miscarriage or ectopic pregnancy. But pro-lifers were consistently outspent. We were outspent 15-1. In the Missouri ballot initiative from last week, we were outspent 10-1 in Florida. And the only reason we even won in Florida was because it was a 60% threshold. Mm. DeSantis did heroic efforts in combating the media lies. But unless you have a politician like DeSantis, pro-life activists don't get to go on, you know, the mainstream television shows and radio shows in the same way that the political class does. And you know, maybe this is a fourth point. I would say with few exceptions, and DeSantis is one of the exceptions, many of our political leaders have retreated from the battle. They've run away from the issue. And we saw how President Trump himself, at first he criticized the Florida law, and it was only after pushback from pro-life activists that he then said, you know, look, I'm going to vote against the pro-abortion ballot initiative. But he said he thought 6 weeks was too soon, that women needed more time to decide, right? More time to decide what? To kill their baby, right? And so we're not getting the pro-life leadership from the top that we need to shape public opinion.
Well, speaking of the top, we're, you know, going to have a very interesting shift here with not just President Trump, but also Vice President J.D. Vance. And, you know, you mentioned these states and how they all have these explicit life of the mother exceptions. And they also... many of these states that have passed very strong pro-life measures have done it in tandem with very generous, to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, programs to help women. And there's definitely, I sense, a shift among some that think that what we need to do is lead with more of a kind of like set aside the abortion topic and instead focus on pro-family politics and legislation that prioritizes the family, that helps make it a better environment for women to bring their babies into the world. And this has definitely been at the center of J.D. Vance's career. And, you know, you allude to this in your article that this can be good, but we also have to be careful that we're not just creating more reverse incentives. And so I want to get your take also on this new piece by Emma Green entitled The New Pro-Life Playbook that just came out in The New Yorker, where she talks about this and the kind of a shifting of the party towards prioritizing the family, or what she calls the family's turn. What's your take on the piece, and what's your take on this push by some in the party, spearheaded very much by J.D. Vance, to make family politics first and foremost, or that's at the center of our conversation on these issues?
Great series of questions. A couple of thoughts. One of the things that I say in the First Things essay is I quote a report that colleagues of mine at EBBC put together, and they looked at every state in the 2 years post Dobbs that had passed a pro-life law protecting unborn babies, also passed a wide variety of measures assisting the mothers of those babies. And some states did this to the tune of like millions of dollars. This is, pre-Dobbs, but a good example of this is back when Texas passed its heartbeat bill. And remember, Texas found a way of going around Roe v. Wade by making it like a private right of action, like a civil procedure where there was no government official who would be enforcing the provision. And so there was nothing for the court to kind of strike down. That same session of the Texas legislature, they also allocated an additional $100 million a year to the Texas Alternatives to Abortion program. Right. And so here you have like a deep red state saying, look, we want to both protect babies from lethal violence, and we're going to do a 6-week bill. We're also going to put money where our mouth is and, actually provide funding for alternatives to abortion. Every state in America that passed pro-life laws in the aftermath of Dobbs did something like that. Many of them did multiple things like that, right? I mean, states would expand how much medical care, how much paid family leave, how much support in terms of like diapers, all sorts of things like this. I think all of that is good. The cautions that I then add about this in the First Things essay is, one, we can't allow this to be a distraction or an alternative to actually passing the laws that protect the babies from the lethal violence. I think there's been a temptation to say, instead of talking about abortion, we'll talk about family policy, or instead of talking about abortion, we'll talk about paid family leave, or we'll talk about expanding Medicaid eligibility for women, et cetera, right? And so I think we have to avoid, it needs to be a both and, not an either or. But then the second thing, and this was something that a different one of our EBBC scholars has pointed out, is that if I'm correct that marriage is the greatest protector of unborn babies, we don't want to create welfare incentives for non-marital relationships and non-marital sex. His big project at EBBC is actually eliminating all of the marriage penalties in the tax code and in the welfare system. Because right now, poor people are not stupid. And right now, you get more welfare benefits if you cohabitate with your lover rather than marrying your lover. And we don't want our welfare system actually incentivizing the behaviors that then lead to abortion, right? And so this is why it's important that if we are going to be telling a young woman you cannot kill your unborn baby, that we rally around that young woman and provide her with supports she needs. But what she needs most is a husband. And it's politically incorrect to say that, but marriage and family is actually what is the long-term solution here. So we need to make sure that any temporary financial supports that we provide are not at odds with the long-term structural supports that all of us need, right? You and I could not be doing what we're doing with our kids if we didn't have our spouses, right? I mean, there's a reason why God designed us this way. And so it's important that the public policy doesn't, for short-term gain, doesn't set up long-term setbacks.
Well, you more than anyone I can think of really have been out there sounding the alarm on the importance of marriage and its connection to all of these issues and the need to strengthen it and protect it. So Thank you for that work, and thank you for your time today and joining us. And I could talk about this all day, but we're out of time. So thank you so much, Ryan.
Yeah,
And
thank you.
for our listeners, you can go to the Ethics and Public Policy Center's website, I'm sure, to find out more information. To find, can they find your articles there as well?
Yep. Each of our scholars, if you go to the eppc.org webpage.
Well, it's always fun to talk with Ryan Anderson about the life issue and about marriage. I think of him as really the epitome of the happy warriors that we're called to be. And he just does such a great job of breaking down the issues, helping us to understand why it is that we are where we are, and helping us to think through where we need to go next. And I think that as pro-lifers, it's important that we be at peace about where we are. And I think Ryan really embodies that peace and gives us a lot to think about, challenges us, and that's important. We can't be complacent. So what a gift to have him on. We'll have to have him back. And for a part two, maybe he and I can discuss our, we both have books on sex differences and gender ideology, another really difficult but important topic. So wonderful to have Ryan on. And next, we're going to turn to a special guest from the Knights of Columbus who's going to be talking to us about a really important video series that they've produced on virtues. And goodness knows that our culture is so lacking in virtue, and I think really craving virtue and hungry for it. And so I think you're going to be really excited to hear about this important video series that they're producing, which is exactly what the culture needs right now. So stay tuned. Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. I am your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and I'm very happy to introduce our guest, who is Dr. Joseph McInerney. He is a retired United States Navy captain and the Vice President of Leadership and Ethics Education for the Knights of Columbus. Welcome to the show, Joe.
It's so good to be with you, Ashley. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And you know, we just marked Veterans Day, so thank you also for your service to our country in the Navy. How long did you serve in the Navy?
I served 29 years active and 1 year in the reserves, so 30 in total.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for that service. And now you're with the Knights of Columbus, which is an amazing fraternal organization that does so much both here and around the world. I think it's got to be one of America's most known and beloved charitable and fraternal organizations. And you have, in your capacity there, helped to launch a new video series called the Leadership Virtue Series. Can you tell us about this project and what prompted you to make this video series?
Well, there were a couple of things that came together to that at the genesis of the series. First is really Patrick Kelly's vision for the Knights. One aspect of that vision is that the Knights can be a place where men can go to become great leaders. And so we wanted to develop a leadership curriculum that would help men really leverage the experience they get in the Knights. One of the great things about the Knights is if you spend any time in the organization, you'll likely end up in a leadership position. And to learn leadership, the best way to do it is to practice it in a position that gives you leadership responsibilities. So the Knights often offer that. What we want to do is match a curriculum that enables people to reflect on those experiences and draw good conclusions from them, and then actually practice to be good leaders. So that's the foundation. And then within the Knights have established what they call the CORE initiative, which is really revitalizing the Knights, re-engaging the men of the Knights of Columbus with the spiritual roots of the Catholic tradition, getting men to CORE meetings are formulated so men pray, they do some formation, and then they spend time in fraternity with one another. So we wanted to develop some videos and content for the formation part of the CORE meeting. And so these videos were designed for men to look at, and we're developing a curriculum of questions and background info so they can discuss the videos also to become the leaders God wants them to be.
In the kind of teaser for the series that I watched, you talk about or you reference a virtue-based approach to ethics versus the kind of modern approach. Can you, what do you mean by that?
Well, we talk about virtues. Virtue is a common word in, the English language, obviously, but it's not, virtue as a concept is not terribly influential in our modern moral culture. Our modern moral culture is focused more on utilitarian approaches to ethics. What are the consequences of my decisions? We might focus on rules or even duties. A 18th century philosopher, Immanuel Kant, focused ethics on duties. The virtue-based approach, actually, the roots of the virtue-based approach come from the Bible, and they also come from the Catholic intellectual tradition that reaches its high point in the high Middle Ages. But since then, with modern moral philosophy, not only the church, but really Western culture has moved away from the virtues. And what we want to do is actually leverage the virtues, which were very simply morally excellent habits, to come back, one, to the tradition of the church, but really to get at the heart of what it means to be a morally excellent human being and how important that is to lead well, is that people are trust morally excellent people, people who are people, leaders who are people of integrity and have excellent moral character, inspire the trust necessary for leaders to influence their followers in really profound ways. So that's one of the reasons that we're focusing on the virtues, because one, we're all creatures of habits, so we want to leverage those habits, which can be enormously powerful, not only to us leading flourishing lives, but enabling us to inspire the trust that will draw followers to a leader.
It's so interesting, and that, really caught my attention, the idea of a virtue-based approach to ethics versus the modern reality, because we hear so much language and verbiage about virtues. In fact, just the phrase virtue signaling is a kind of a part of our lingo, and it's like so much of products and food and everything is marketed with this language about virtue, and yet it's totally hollow. In fact, there's a restaurant in the area where I live called Virtue Feed and Grain, and it's like, well, what do you mean for,
Right, right.
and so there is truly a real need to reclaim even what virtue means to begin with, and what these words are that we're sort of drenched in that are kind of actually empty. So do you, I mean, have you found that there's an interest for your series, and if so, who's the audience?
Well, I think intrinsically there's an interest for virtue-based approach to life, just because people want to live full and flourishing lives, and that's the promise of the right understanding of virtues. It's so interesting that you bring up the empty aspect of it too, because it just there's it's like iPhones. They're incredible tools, and they can be used for good and for bad. A term like virtue can have tremendous depth of meaning, and we can use it in a very superficial way. And I think virtue signaling is you're exactly right. That's a superficial way to use the idea. But virtue in that sense, so the word for virtue in classical Greek language is arete. And arete can be translated in two ways. It can be translated as virtue, or it can be translated as excellence, actually. And so we wanted to, you apply it in the context of ethics. Virtue is a morally excellent habit, so to speak. So we want to get at that kind of depth. And this, we find, to be honest, I think it appeals to men and women, but I think it particularly can appeal to the men of the Knights of Columbus, who were obviously trying to aim at and say, this virtues offer the strength that is available to us in the gospel, that Christ is the perfect man, the perfect human being. And we can see very clearly in the New Testament, both in the Gospels and in the epistles, that he was a person of virtue. And so for us to reach our potential as his followers, we have to become persons of virtue as well.
What are the virtues that you really delve into this series?
Well, this series really is kind of a beginning, because there are so many virtues. The church's tradition focuses on theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, or love. And then there's the cardinal virtues of prudence and temperance, courage, and justice. And underneath those four cardinal virtues is a whole host of virtues. So the ver a discussion on virtue can be very long, because there's so many. What we have focused on in this first approach to leadership are what we think are the key virtues. First of all, if a virtue is an excellent habit, the first habit for every Christian person, men and women, has to be prayer. Habitual prayer is the foundation of our ability to do the good things God is asking us to do in our lives. And then from there, we look at two virtues that are particularly important for leadership. The first is magnanimity, is the traditional title for this and for that virtue. And that's the ability to recognize your God-given strengths and talents. That's something that every leader needs to be able to do. And the parallel, or maybe the opposite pole of that, is the virtue of humility, where a person, and humility is a very rich, morally excellent habit. But just to put it concisely, humility is the ability to recognize one's weaknesses. And so magnanimity and humility are these two virtues that are kind of in tension with one another, but they are both crucial to excellent leadership. Leaders need to be both magnanimous and humble if they want to be effective. So we start there with those two virtues after we talk about prayer in the series.
Do you think that there's virtues that I'm trying to think of how to formulate this question, but I'm interested in sex differences. I've written a book about the differences between men and women. And are
Yes.
there virtues that men struggle with more, and or are there virtues that men are more called to, if you get the gist of my
Yeah,
question?
that's a great question. And to be honest, Ashley, it's not something that I've thought about too much because obviously I'm a man, so I approach this from my own particular strengths and weaknesses, and which are imbued with my own masculinity. I would say one thing that men can struggle with particularly is the virtue of temperance. It's the type of thing I used to say this to my students at the Naval Academy when I was teaching there. Can you get too much of a good thing? And all the guys in the room, they would just be shaking their heads saying, "No way, you can't do it." And I'd be like, "Well, actually, yes, you can. You can have too much pizza and you can have too much beer." So God's created us in this such a wonderful, beautiful way, in this differentiation between men and women. And I think it's hard to make general claims about the particular virtues for both of the genders, because I think there's so much of your individual personality, your own formation that is bound up with that. And that's why there's a transcendent aspect of the virtues. So men and women equally can be prudent. They can equally be just and temperate and brave and courageous, just to use the four cardinal virtues. But it'll manifest differently in men and women's lives, I think, too. And that's probably a really rich subject to explore. It's not one that I would want to claim any expertise on, though.
Well, you mentioned teaching at the Naval Academy, and I think that, we really associate so much virtue with the military and military service and learning in a military environment. And, I was going to ask you about your trajectory from being in the Navy to producer of a video series, but, how do you think your time in the military, 30 years of service really helped give you kind of a baptism by fire in the virtues?
Absolutely. And I think this happens in basic training for all the services. For my basic training did happen at the Naval Academy when I was a student there. They call it plebe summer. And especially for young men and women, it's really an overwhelming experience. A lot of times your head is shaved if you're a guy. If you're a woman, you get a very short haircut. You're kind of almost made anonymous and you're put into a platoon or a unit. And then you're challenged both physically and intellectually. The kind of the philosophy or the background is you kind of break people down and then build them up. And for me, that was a time to be renewed in a lot of ways in habituation. I did not realize it at the time at all. But that experience kind of set a foundation in which I could begin to build good habits. And so I think that's one of the great gifts that military service has to offer military members, is it the environment is structured, but it's also very powerful, and the intensity can produce morally excellent habits in a way that's unique. And I think I've definitely benefited from them. I've got a long way to go. You can ask my wife how many vices I have, which are bad habits, but I can tell you I've come a long way too, and my military experience, I have to admit, is a big part of that.
Well, it's just so wonderfully refreshing to even hear somebody kind of speaking plainly and boldly about virtue in a culture that just doesn't value it, even if it, co-opts its language. But so the Knights of Columbus, I mean, is another the It's endurance despite the culture, I think, is really a testament to the organization. And how long have you been a member of the Knights of Columbus? And to what do you ascribe the fact that it's just still this thriving organization, despite kind of the bottoming out of the culture and the devaluation of kind of single sex organizations, institutions, even education?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really interesting. At the time of the founding of the Knights, there were many fraternal, hundreds of fraternal organizations in the United States. There are only a handful that are left. And you're right, the Knights are there, and the organization is quite large, and it is dynamic, and it's fruitful. It's not a perfect organization. We have to renew ourselves, and we constantly have to work hard to do that. I think the foundation of it was founded by a priest, Blessed Michael McGivney, and the foundation of it for its enduring is the Holy Spirit. There's nothing else I can point to. As long as the Knights are engaged in prayer and keeping, God's Spirit, Christ, Christ's Spirit at the center of what we do, I think we will persevere. And if we get away from that foundation, we will struggle just like any other organization. So I think that's at the heart of it. It's also, your question is great because there's complexity there. There are other aspects of the Knights that help give life to the spirit within the organization, whether it's our structures or the different things that we're able to do, whether it's the charitable works. Charity is something that draws men into the organization. That's something that we're known for, and so that certainly has helped keep us alive over the time. But I mean, I think that endurance is a gift of God's Spirit, to put it simply.
I also think, you mentioned humility as kind of a really key virtue, and I know you have a book about it. And I think when I think of the Knights, I think of humility. I think of all the hidden work that's done behind the scenes. There's no, I volunteer with a women's pregnancy resource organization, and it's the Knights who assemble the cribs, and they just show
Right,
up and they assemble the
right.
cribs and then they leave, and they're not out there boasting about it. And or if it's, like the pancake breakfast, they're just kind of doing this quiet, humble service, and it's just such a beautiful thing. Well, we're almost out of time, but tell us, where can people who are interested go to see these video series, and where can they find out, about your work and your books and all of this?
So the videos can be found on the Knights website, which is KOFC, not KFC, it's in Kentucky Fried Chicken, KOFC.org/virtues. And the primer for the video is there. You can just jump in like you have. Right now, we're offering the videos as a function of membership. So to watch the video series for men, we need them to sign up, and we would love for people to sign up to so they can have access to the videos. And the videos really are based on some research I did a number of years ago, and that's contained in a monograph that I published with the Knights on the Knights Catholic Information Service. The title of that monograph is Passion and Paradox: The Leadership Genius of Jesus Christ. And so if you're more interested in reading a version of this, that monograph is a little, it's about 60 pages long, so it's broader than the videos themselves, but that's something to that would give a little more depth to what the videos offer also.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Dr. Joseph McInerney, who is with the Knights of Columbus and the producer of the Leadership Virtue series, a video series about the virtues. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley. It's been a treat to be with you.
Thank you. We wish all of our listeners a very happy new year, the best in the new year, and we hope that you'll join our conversations this year. And we'd love to hear from you. Feel free to follow us on social media. Find us on Facebook at the Catholic Association. Also on Twitter or X, you can find us at Catholic Associ. Feel free to drop us a line or question or offer any topics you'd love for us to delve into. And you can always catch the latest at thecatholicassociation.org. And now Father Roger Landry offers us a thought-provoking homily to prepare us for this Sunday's gospel.
Happy New Year. This is Monsignor Roger Landry, and it's a joy to have a chance to ponder with you the consequential conversation God wants to have with us this Sunday. As the Church celebrates the solemnity of the Epiphany of the Lord, his manifestation to all the nations represented by the wise men coming from afar. There are many angles by which we can approach this great encounter. We can focus on the meaning of the homage or adoration the Magi give Jesus when they arrive. We can meditate on the gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We can ponder the significance of the star. But insofar as I have just begun full-time my new work as National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies in the United States, I'd like to look at the Epiphany from the perspective of how Christ is the light Isaiah prophesies in Sunday's first reading that would shine over all peoples so that the nations would walk by his light and kings by his shining radiance. Jesus is that light from light who came into the world to illumine not just Jews, not just those who would eventually become baptized Christians, but all peoples everywhere. Over the course of the centuries, this is the most traditional way by which Christians have looked at the solemnity of the Epiphany. The prophets Isaiah, Daniel, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel had all announced God's intention to be a savior of all peoples. But the visit of these non-Jewish magi from afar was understood by the first Christians as the initial fulfillment of that plan. They were the first, but certainly not the last, in a great procession prophesied by Isaiah that has taken place over the course of the centuries, as non-Jews from the east and the west, the north and the south, have come to Bethlehem to find in the newborn Jesus their Savior, their light, and their salvation. The wise men were first seeking God, longing for him arduously, in God's first epiphany, which is the manifestation of God as Creator. They were seeking him in the stars the Creator had made. Following that light with a small L, they were seeking the light with a capital L. Theirs is an extraordinary witness. Perhaps moved by the ancient Sibylline prophecies that Michelangelo depicted in the Sistine Chapel, or even by Balaam's prophecy from the book of Numbers, when he said, "A star shall come forth out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel." When they saw the star at its rising, they not only interpreted that God was trying to communicate something to them in general, but that God was specifically heralding the birth of the newborn king in the east, who would be a universal king. 2,000 years ago, in the deserts of the Middle East and on the seas, people we know were highly dependent on the fixed stars in the sky as references for their direction. They firmly believed that God had made them that way for that reason. Whenever anything happened in the sky that was new, like the appearance of a comet or a meteor shower or planets or stars shining more brightly, the ancients thought that it had to bear some message from the Creator of the heavens. When they saw the star of Bethlehem at its rising, they didn't respond just as curious astrologers, but as those who hungered to find what they had long through their studies sought. Led by the star and their simple trust in its supposed meaning, the wise men went on a journey toward the Holy Land. Pope Francis said that they reflect the image of all those who long for God, but also asked why they alone sought it, why they alone saw the star. And he answered, because they hadn't ceased raising their eyes to heaven. Many, he said, can keep their gaze fixed on earthly realities and creature comforts. Many, likewise, he said, only go for what's flashing. Perhaps the star, he conjectured, was not that eye-catching, or that much brighter than other stars and worldly lights. As a 4th-century bishop quipped, the star was seen by everyone, but not everyone understood its meaning. Likewise, our Lord and Savior was born for everyone, but not everyone has welcomed him. Unlike many of their contemporaries, the wise men, seeing the star, were willing to make the decision to take up the journey. They overcame every sense of self-sufficiency, the anesthetization of their hearts, their refusal to seek more out of life, or the fears they might have had of taking risks. They were willing, in fact, eager to be changed, and they set out tirelessly on a journey. We don't know their itinerary, but the gospel gives us indications that their pilgrimage was long in time and distance. Herod asked them the exact time of the appearance of the star, and then a short time later, after they didn't return, he proceeded to kill every boy in Bethlehem under 2 years of age. And so it seems that the time of their preparation and the journey to get there probably took 18 to 20 months, up to 2 years. And then there was the journey back. Whether they walked or had the help of animals, we don't know, but we do know that they made the journey of several years in great distance because they believed God was speaking to them through the star. They were seeking the truth, and they were willing to make the sacrifices that seeking and living the truth entail. They showed by their journey that they had placed God, however they understood him at the beginning of their journey, at the center of their life. And when they arrived, in Bethlehem, worship, we see, was the end and goal of their journey. To worship means to center one's life on God rather than oneself. It means to sacrifice what's non-essential for the one thing necessary, and God is that one thing. And here, finally, we come to the role of the church and the summons to mission. When St. John Paul II would preach about the Epiphany, this great pilgrim pope of evangelization would say that the church's missionary activity finds its starting point in universal scope in the Feast of the Epiphany. The journey of the Magi from the East, he said in 1995, is like a great symbol of all those roads on which men from near and far, from the extreme ends of the earth, walk over the centuries toward the light of Christ. He who now, newborn, allows himself to be found and worshipped by the Magi, one day at the end of his earthly mission, will say to the apostles, "Go to the whole world and preach the gospel to every creature." And with these words, he will imprint a precise direction to the history of the church. Those who have succeeded the apostles in the mission to bring light to all the nations, to preach to all nations, have indicated to men the same way, saying, "Go to Bethlehem. There Christ is born. Go to Nazareth. There he spent 30 years of his hidden life. Stop on the shores of the Lake Galilee and in many places of the Holy Land, where he taught and worked miracles, giving signs of his divine power. And above all, go to Jerusalem, where he was crucified to take away the sins of the world and reveal himself as the Redeemer of man. Go to Jerusalem, where he's risen on the third day, manifesting the power of life that is in him, life stronger than physical and spiritual death." During his first celebration of this feast, a successor of St. Peter, he said in 1979, "The Magi are the beginning and the prefiguration of all those who from beyond the frontiers of the chosen people of the Old Covenant have reached and still reach Christ by means of faith. The Epiphany is the feast of the vitality of the church. The church lives her awareness of God's mission, which is carried out through her. Mission is the proper name of the church and in a certain sense defines her. The church becomes herself when she carries out her mission. The church is herself when men, such as the shepherds and the Magi kings from the East, reach Jesus Christ by means of faith." He said that the church is meant to be more aware of the vastness of her mission every year as a result of the Epiphany, to realize how many men it's still necessary to bring to faith, how many men must be won back to the faith, which they've lost, and that it's sometimes more difficult than the first conversion of faith. But the church, he said, aware of that great gift, the gift of the incarnation of God, can never stop or tire. She must continually seek access to Bethlehem for every man and for every period. The Epiphany is the feast of God's challenge, he underlined. The Epiphany is the feast of God's challenge to you, to me, and to the whole church. It's a challenge to become true missionaries, reflecting the light of Christ, radiant like stars, leading people to Bethlehem, Nazareth, Calvary, and ultimately to the eternal Jerusalem. As we are transformed by our own encounter with the baby Jesus, we, like the Magi, are meant to leave Bethlehem by another route, sent out as modern Melchiors, Balthazars, and Caspars, as wise men, able to lead others to the source of wisdom, so that all those searching for God in the stars or in the sciences, even in other religions, may come to discover with us in Jesus the glory of God in the highest and the road to peace on earth. And so, as we prepare for the Epiphany on Sunday, let us go with haste to Bethlehem and pray for the grace to live up to God's missionary challenge, to help bring all the nations, indeed every creature, to Christ who is God with us. Happy New Year, happy Feast of the Epiphany, happy Jubilee of Hope. This is a year in which we seek to bring many to that source of hope, Christ himself. God bless you.
Thank you, Father Roger Landry. Make sure to catch all of his great work at catholicpreaching.com, or you can follow his writings at the National Catholic Register. Go to ncregister.com. And until next time, we wish you all the very best. And you go with our prayers.